19. Outside 217. Danny was remembering the words of someone else who had worked at the Overlook during the season. Her saying she'd seen something in one of the rooms where a bad thing happened. That was in room 217, and I want you to promise me you won't go in there, Danny. Steer right clear. It was a perfectly ordinary door, no different from any other door on the first two floors of the hotel. It was dark gray, halfway down a corridor that ran at right angles to the main second-floor hallway. The numbers on the door looked no different from the house numbers on the Boulder apartment building they had lived in. A 2, a 1, and a 7. Big deal. Just below them was a tiny glass circle, a peephole. Danny had tried several of them. From the inside, you got a wide, fisheye view of the corridor. From outside, you could screw up your eyes 7 ways to Sunday and still not see a thing. A dirty jip. Why are you here? After the walk behind the Overlook, he and Mommy had come back and she had fixed him his favorite lunch, a cheese and bologna sandwich plus Campbell's bean soup. They ate in Dick's kitchen and talked. The radio was on, getting thin and crackly music from the Estes Park station. The kitchen was his favorite place in the hotel, and he guessed that Mommy and Daddy must feel the same way, because after trying their meals in the dining room for 3 days or so, they had begun eating in the kitchen by mutual consent, setting up chairs around Dick Halloran's butcher block, which was almost as big as their dining room table back in Stovington anyway. The dining room had been too depressing, even with the lights on and the music playing from the tape cassette system in the office. You were still just one of 3 people sitting at a table surrounded by dozens of other tables, all empty, all covered with those transparent plastic dust cloths. Mommy said it was like having dinner in the middle of a Horace Walpole novel, and Daddy had laughed and agreed. Danny had no idea who Horace Walpole was, but he did know that Mommy's cooking had begun to taste better as soon as they began to eat it in the kitchen. He kept discovering little flashes of Dick Halloran's personality lying around, and they reassured him like a warm touch. Mommy had eaten half a sandwich, no soup. She said Daddy must have gone out for a walk of his own since both the VW and the hotel truck were in the parking lot. She said she was tired and might lie down for an hour or so, if he thought he could amuse himself and not get into trouble. Danny told her around a mouthful of cheese and bologna that he thought he could. "Why don't you go out into the playground?" she asked him. "I thought you'd love that place with a sandbox for your trucks and all." He swallowed, and the food went down his throat in a lump that was dry and hard. "Maybe I will," he said, turning to the radio and fiddling with it. "And all those neat hedge animals," she said, taking his empty plate. "Your father's got to get out and trim them pretty soon." "Yeah," he said. "Just nasty things. Once it had to do with those damn hedges clipped to look like animals." "If you see your father before I do, tell him I'm lying down."
"Sure, Mom."
She put the dirty dishes in the sink and came back over to him.
"Are you happy here, Danny?"
He looked at her guilelessly, a milk mustache on his lip.
"Uh-huh." "No more bad dreams?"
"No." Tony had come to him once, one night while he was lying in bed, calling his name faintly and from far away. Danny had squeezed his eyes tightly shut until Tony had gone.
"You sure?"
"Yes, Mom." She seemed satisfied.
"How's your hand?"
He flexed it for her.
"All better."
She nodded. Jack had taken the nest under the Pyrex bowl, full of frozen wasps, out to the incinerator in back of the equipment shed and burned it. They had seen no more wasps since. He had written to a lawyer in Boulder, enclosing the snaps of Danny's hand, and the lawyer had called back 2 days ago. That had put Jack in a foul temper all afternoon. The lawyer doubted if the company that had manufactured the bug bomb could be sued successfully, because there was only Jack to testify that he had followed directions printed on the package. Jack had asked the lawyer if they couldn't purchase some others and test them for the same defect. Yes, the lawyer said, but the results were highly doubtful, even if all the test bombs malfunctioned. He told Jack of a case that involved an extension ladder company and a man who had broken his back. Wendy had commiserated with Jack, but privately she had just been glad that Danny had gotten off as cheaply as he had. It was best to leave lawsuits to people who understood them, and that did not include the Torrances. And they had seen no more wasps since.
"Go and play, Doc. Have fun."
But he hadn't had fun. He had wandered aimlessly around the hotel, poking into the maids' closets and the janitor's rooms, looking for something interesting, not finding it, a small boy padding along a dark blue carpet woven with twisting black lines. He had tried a room door from time to time, but of course they were all locked. The passkey was hanging down in the office, he knew where, but Daddy had told him he shouldn't touch that. And he didn't want to. Did he? Why are you here? There was nothing aimless about it after all. He had been drawn to room 217 by a morbid kind of curiosity. He remembered a story Daddy had read to him once when he was drunk. That had been a long time ago, but the story was just as vivid now as when Daddy had read it to him. Mommy had scolded Daddy and asked what he was doing, reading a 3-year-old baby something so horrible. The name of the story was Bluebeard. That was clear in his mind, too, because he had thought at first Daddy was saying Blue Bird, and there were no bluebirds in the story, or birds of any kind, for that matter. Actually, the story was about Bluebeard's wife, a pretty lady that had corn-colored hair like Mommy. After Bluebeard married her, they lived in a big and ominous castle that was not unlike the Overlook. And every day Bluebeard went off to work, and every day he would tell his pretty little wife not to look in a certain room, although the key to that room was hanging right on a hook, just like the passkey was hanging on the office wall downstairs. Bluebeard's wife had gotten more and more curious about the locked room. She tried to peep through the keyhole, the way Danny had tried to look through room 217's peephole, with similar unsatisfying results. There was even a picture of her getting down on her knees and trying to look under the door, but the crack wasn't wide enough. The door swung wide, and the old fairy tale book had depicted her discovery in ghastly, loving detail. The image was burned on Danny's mind. The severed heads of Bluebeard's 7 previous wives were in the room, each one on its own pedestal, the eyes turned up to whites, the mouths unhinged and gaping in silent screams. They were somehow balanced on necks ragged from the broadsword's decapitating swing, and there was blood running down the pedestals. Terrified, she had turned to flee from the room and the castle, only to discover Bluebeard standing in the doorway, his terrible eyes blazing. "I told you not to enter this room," Bluebeard said, unsheathing his sword. "Alas, in your curiosity you are like the other 7, and though I loved you best of all, your ending shall be as was theirs. Prepare to die, wretched woman." It seemed vaguely to Danny that the story had had a happy ending, but that had paled to insignificance beside the 2 dominant images: the taunting, maddening locked door with some great secret behind it, and the grisly secret itself, repeated more than 6 times. The locked door, and behind it the heads, the severed heads. His hand reached out and stroked the room's doorknob almost furtively. He had no idea how long he had been here, standing hypnotized before the bland, gray, locked door. "And maybe 3 I've thought I've seen things. Nasty things." But Mr. Halloran, Dick, had also said he didn't think those things could hurt you. They were like scary pictures in a book, that was all, and maybe he wouldn't see anything. On the other hand, he plunged his left hand into his pocket, and it came out holding the passkey. It had been there all along, of course. He held it by the square metal tab on the end, which had "Office" printed on it in magic marker. He twirled the key on its chain, watching it go around and around. After several minutes of this, he stopped and slipped the passkey into the lock. It slid in smoothly, with no hitch, as if it had wanted to be there all along. "I've thought I've seen things. Nasty things. Promise me you won't go in there." "I promise." And a promise was, of course, very important. Still, his curiosity itched at him as maddeningly as poison ivy in a place you aren't supposed to scratch. But it was a dreadful kind of curiosity, the kind that makes you peek through your fingers during the scariest parts of a scary movie. What was beyond that door would be no movie. "I don't think those things can hurt you, like scary pictures in a book." Suddenly he reached out with his left hand, not sure of what it was going to do until it had removed the passkey and stuffed it back into his pocket. He stared at the door a moment longer, blue-gray eyes wide, then turned quickly and walked back down the corridor toward the main hallway that ran at right angles to the corridor he was in. Something made him pause there, and he wasn't sure what for a moment. Then he remembered that directly around this corner, on the way back to the stairs, there was one of those old-fashioned fire extinguishers curled up against the wall, curled there like a dozing snake. They weren't chemical-type extinguishers at all, Daddy said, although there were several of those in the kitchen. These were the forerunner of the modern sprinkler systems. The long canvas hoses hooked directly into the Overlook's plumbing system, and by turning a single valve, you could become a one-man fire department. Daddy said that the chemical extinguishers, which sprayed foam or CO2, were much better. The chemicals smothered fires, took away the oxygen they needed to burn, while a high-pressure spray might just spread the flames around. Daddy said that Mr. Ullman should replace the old-fashioned hoses, right along with the old-fashioned boiler, but Mr. Ullman would probably do neither, because he was a cheap prick. Danny knew that this was one of the worst epithets his father could summon. It was applied to certain doctors, dentists, and appliance repairmen, and also to the head of his English department at Stovington, who had disallowed some of Daddy's book orders because he said the books would put them over budget. Over budget, hell, he had fumed to Wendy. Danny had been listening from his bedroom, where he was supposed to be asleep. He's just saving the last 500 bucks for himself, the cheap prick. Danny looked around the corner. The extinguisher was there, a flat hose folded back a dozen times on itself, the red tank attached to the wall. Above it was an axe in a glass case like a museum exhibit, with white words printed on a red background. In case of emergency, break glass. Danny could read the word emergency, which was also the name of one of his favorite TV shows, but was unsure of the rest. But he didn't like the way the word was used in connection with that long, flat hose. Emergency was fire, explosions, car crashes, hospitals, sometimes death. And he didn't like the way that hose hung so blandly on the wall. When he was alone, he always skittered past these extinguishers as fast as he could. No particular reason. It just felt better to go fast. It felt safer. Now, heart thumping loudly in his chest, he came around the corner and looked down the hall past the extinguisher to the stairs. Mommy was down there sleeping, and if Daddy was back from his walk, he would probably be sitting in the kitchen, eating a sandwich and reading a book. He would just walk right past that old extinguisher and go downstairs. He started toward it, moving closer to the far wall until his right arm was brushing the expensive silk paper. 20 steps away, 15, a dozen. When he was 10 steps away, the brass nozzle suddenly rolled off the fat loop it had been lying, sleeping, on, and fell to the hall carpet with a dull thump. It lay there, the dark bore of its muzzle pointing at Danny. He stopped immediately, his shoulders twitching forward with the suddenness of his scare. His blood thumped thickly in his ears and temples. His mouth had gone dry and sour, his hands curled into fists. Yet the nozzle of the hose only lay there, its brass casing glowing mellowly, a loop of flat canvas leading back up to the red-painted frame bolted to the wall. So it had fallen off. So what? It was only a fire extinguisher, nothing else. It was stupid to think that it looked like some poison snake from Wide World of Animals that had heard him and woken up. Even if the stitched canvas did look a little bit like scales, he would just step over it and go down the hall to the stairs, walking a little bit fast, maybe, to make sure it didn't snap out after him and curl around his foot. He wiped his lips with his left hand, in unconscious imitation of his father, and took a step forward. No movement from the hose. Another step. Nothing. There, see how stupid you are? You got all worked up thinking about that dumb room and that dumb Bluebeard story, and that hose was probably ready to fall off for the last 5 years, that's all. Danny stared at the hose on the floor and thought of wasps. 8 steps away, the nozzle of the hose gleamed peacefully at him from the rug as if to say, "Don't worry, I'm just a hose, that's all. And even if that isn't all, what I do to you won't be much worse than a bee sting or a wasp sting. What would I want to do to a nice little boy like you, except bite and bite and bite?" Danny took another step and another. His breath was dry and harsh in his throat. Panic was close now. He began to wish the hose would move, then at last he would know, he would be sure. He took another step, and now he was within striking distance. "But it's not going to strike at you," he thought hysterically. "How can it strike at you, bite at you, when it's just a hose? Maybe it's full of wasps." His internal temperature plummeted to 10 below zero.
He stared at the black bore in the center of the nozzle, nearly hypnotized. Maybe it was full of wasps, secret wasps, their brown bodies bloated with poison, so full of autumn poison that it dripped from their stingers in clear drops of fluid. Suddenly he knew that he was nearly frozen with terror. If he did not make his feet go now, they would become locked to the carpet, and he would stay here, staring at the black hole in the center of the brass nozzle like a bird staring at a snake. He would stay here until his daddy found him, and then what would happen? With a high moan, he made himself run. As he reached the hose, some trick of the light made the nozzle seem to move, to revolve as if to strike, and he leaped high in the air above it. In his panicky state, it seemed that his legs pushed him nearly all the way to the ceiling, that he could feel the stiff back hairs that formed his cowlick brushing the hallway's plaster ceiling, although later he knew that couldn't have been so. He came down on the other side of the hose and ran, and suddenly he heard it behind him, coming for him, the soft, dry wicker of that brass snake's head as it slithered rapidly along the carpet after him, like a rattlesnake moving swiftly through a dry field of grass. It was coming for him, and suddenly the stairs seemed very far away. They seemed to retreat a running step into the distance for each running step he took toward them. "Daddy!" he tried to scream, but his closed throat would not allow a word to pass. He was on his own. Behind him, the sound grew louder, the dry, sliding sound of the snake slipping swiftly over the carpet's dry hackles. At his heels now, perhaps rising up with clear poison dribbling from its brass snout. Danny reached the stairs and had to pinwheel his arms crazily for balance. For one moment, it seemed sure that he would cartwheel over and go head for heels to the bottom. He threw a glance back over his shoulder. The hose had not moved. It lay as it had lain, one loop off the frame, the brass nozzle on the hall floor, the nozzle pointing disinterestedly away from him. "You see, stupid," he berated himself. "You made it all up, scaredy cat. It was all your imagination, scaredy cat, scaredy cat." He clung to the stairway railing, his legs trembling in reaction. "It never chased you," his mind told him, and seized on that thought and played it back. "Never chased you, never chased you, never did, never did." It was nothing to be afraid of. Why, he could go back and put that hose right into its frame if he wanted to. He could, but he didn't think he would. Because what if it had chased him and had gone back when it saw that it couldn't quite catch him? The hose lay on the carpet, almost seeming to ask him if he would like to come back and try again. Panting, Danny ran downstairs. 20. Talking to Mr. Ullman. The Sidewinder Public Library was a small, retiring building one block down from the town's business area. It was a modest, vine-covered building, and the wide concrete walk up to the door was lined with the corpses of last summer's flowers. On the lawn was a large bronze statue of a Civil War general Jack had never heard of, although he had been something of a Civil War buff in his teenage years. The newspaper files were kept downstairs. They consisted of the Sidewinder Gazette that had gone bust in 1963, the Estes Park Daily, and the Boulder Camera. No Denver papers at all. Sighing, Jack settled for the Camera. When the files reached 1965, the actual newspapers were replaced by spools of microfilm. "A federal grant," the librarian told him brightly. "We hope to do 1958 to 64 when the next check comes through, but they're so slow, aren't they? You will be careful, won't you? I just know you will. Call if you need me." The only reading machine had a lens that had somehow gotten warped, and by the time Wendy put her hand on his shoulder some 45 minutes after he had switched from the actual papers, he had a juicy thumper of a headache. "Danny's in the park," she said, "but I don't want him outside too long. How much longer do you think you'll be?"
10 minutes, he said. Actually, he had traced down the last of the Overlook's fascinating history, the years between the gangland shooting and the takeover by Stuart Ullman and company, but he felt the same reticence about telling Wendy.
"What are you up to, anyway?" she asked.
She ruffled his hair as she said it, but her voice was only half-teasing.
"Looking up some old Overlook history," he said. "Any particular reason?"
"No, and why the hell are you so interested, anyway?"
"Just curiosity."
"Find anything interesting?"
"Not much," he said,
having to strive to keep his voice pleasant now. She was prying, just the way she had always pried and poked at him when they had been at Stovington and Danny was still a crib infant.
Where are you going, Jack? When will you be back? How much money do you have with you? Are you going to take the car? Is Al going to be with you? Will one of you stay sober? On and on.
She had, pardon the expression, driven him to drink. Maybe that hadn't been the only reason, but by Christ, let's tell the truth here and admit it was one of them. Nag and nag and nag until you wanted to clout her one just to shut her up and stop the where, when, how, are you, will you, endless flow of questions. It could give you a real headache, hangover, headache. The reader, the damned reader with its distorted print, that was why he had such a cunt of a headache.
Jack, are you all right? You look pale.
He snapped his head away from her fingers. I am fine.
She recoiled from his hot eyes and tried on a smile that was a size too small. Well, if you are, I'll just go and wait in the park with Danny.
She was starting away now, her smile dissolving into a bewildered expression of hurt.
He called to her. Wendy?
She looked back from the foot of the stairs.
What, Jack?
He got up and went over to her.
I'm sorry, babe. I guess I'm really not all right. That machine, the lens is distorted. I've got a really bad headache. Got any aspirin?
Sure. She pawed in her purse and came up with a tin of Anacin.
You keep them.
He took the tin.
No Excedrin?
He saw the small recoil on her face and understood. It had been a bitter sort of joke between them at first, before the drinking had gotten too bad for jokes. He had claimed that Excedrin was the only non-prescription drug ever invented that could stop a hangover dead in its tracks. Absolutely the only one. He had begun to think of his morning after thumpers as Excedrin headache number VAT-69.
No Excedrin, she said. Sorry.
That's okay, he said. These'll do just fine. But of course they wouldn't, and she should have known it too. At times she could be the stupidest bitch.
Want some water? She asked brightly.
No, I just want you to get the fuck out of here.
I'll get some at the drinking fountain when I go up, thanks.
Okay. She started up the stairs, good legs moving gracefully under a short tan wool skirt.
We'll be in the park.
Right. He slipped the tin of Anacin absently into his pocket, went back to the reader, and turned it off. When he was sure she was gone, he went upstairs himself. God, but it was a lousy headache. If you were going to have a vice gripper like this one, you ought to at least be allowed the pleasure of a few drinks to balance it off. He tried to put the thought from his mind, more ill-tempered than ever. He went to the main desk, fingering a matchbook cover with a telephone number on it.
Ma'am, do you have a pay telephone?
No, sir, but you can use mine if it's local.
It's long distance, sorry.
Well, then, I guess the drugstore would be your best bet. They have a booth.
Thanks.
He went out and down the walk, past the anonymous Civil War general. He began to walk toward the business block, hands stuffed in his pockets, head thudding like a leaden bell. The sky was also leaden. It was November 7th, and with the new month, the weather had become threatening. There had been a number of snow flurries. There had been snow in October, too, but that had melted. The new flurries had stayed, a light frosting over everything. It sparkled in the sunlight, like fine crystal. But there had been no sunlight today, and even as he reached the drugstore, it began to spit snow again. The phone booth was at the back of the building, and he was halfway down an aisle of patent medicines, jingling his change in his pocket, when his eyes fell on the white boxes with their green print. He took one of them to the cashier, paid, and went back to the telephone booth. He pulled the door closed, put his change and matchbook cover on the counter, and dialed zero.
Your call, please?
Fort Lauderdale, Florida, operator. He gave her the number there and the number in the booth. When she told him it would be $1.90 for the first 3 minutes, he dropped 8 quarters into the slot, wincing each time the bell bonged in his ear. Then, left in limbo with only the faraway clickings and gabblings of connection-making, he took the green bottle of Excedrin out of its box, pried up the white cap, and dropped the wad of cotton batting to the floor of the booth. Cradling the phone receiver between his ear and shoulder, he shook out 3 of the white tablets and lined them up on the counter beside his remaining change. He recapped the bottle and put it in his pocket. At the other end, the phone was picked up on the first ring.
Surf Sand Resort, how may we help you?
The perky female voice asked.
I'd like to speak with the manager, please. Do you mean Mr. Trent or—
I mean Mr. Ullman.
I believe Mr. Ullman is busy, but if you would like me to check...
I would. Tell him it's Jack Torrance, calling from Colorado.
One moment, please.
She put him on hold. Jack's dislike for that cheap, self-important little prick Ullman came flooding back. He took one of the Excedrins from the counter, regarded it for a moment, then put it into his mouth and began to chew it, slowly and with relish. The taste flooded back like memory, making his saliva squirt in mingled pleasure and unhappiness. A dry, bitter taste, but a compelling one. He swallowed with a grimace. Chewing aspirin had been a habit with him in his drinking days. He hadn't done it at all since then. But when your headache was bad enough, a hangover headache or one like this one, chewing them seemed to make them get to work quicker. He had read somewhere that chewing aspirin could become addictive. Where had he read that anyway? Frowning, he tried to think. And then Ullman came on the line.
Torrance? What's the trouble?
No trouble, he said. The boiler's okay, and I haven't even gotten around to murdering my wife yet. I'm saving that until after the holidays when things get dull.
Very funny. Why are you calling? I'm a busy...
Busy man, yes, I understand that. I'm calling about some things that you didn't tell me during your history of the Overlook's great and honorable past. Like how Horace Derwent sold it to a bunch of Las Vegas Sharpies who dealt it through so many dummy corporations that not even the IRS knew who really owned it. About how they waited until the time was right and then turned it into a playground for mafia bigwigs, and about how it had to be shut down in 1966 when one of them got a little bit dead, along with his bodyguards who were standing outside the door to the presidential suite. Great place, the Overlook's presidential suite. Wilson, Harding, Roosevelt, Nixon, and Vito the Chopper, right? There was a moment of surprised silence on the other end of the line, and then Ullman said quietly,
I don't see how that can have any bearing on your job, Mr. Torrance.
The best part happened after Gianelli was shot, though, don't you think? Two more quick shuffles, now you see it and now you don't, and then the Overlook is suddenly owned by a private citizen, a woman named Sylvia Hunter, who just happened to be Sylvia Hunter Derwent from 1942 to 1948.
Your 3 minutes are up, the operator said. Signal went through.
My dear Mr. Torrance, all of this is public knowledge and ancient history.
It formed no part of my knowledge, Jack said. I doubt if many other people know it either.
Not all of it. They remember the Gianelli shooting, maybe, but I doubt if anybody has put together all the wondrous and strange shuffles the Overlook has been through since 1945, and it always seems like Derwent or a Derwent associate comes up with the door prize. What was Sylvia Hunter running up there in 67 and 68, Mr. Ullman? It was a whorehouse, wasn't it?
Torrance!
His shock crackled across 2,000 miles of telephone cable without losing a thing. Smiling, Jack popped another Excedrin into his mouth and chewed it. She sold out after a rather well-known U.S. senator died of a heart attack up there. There were rumors that he was found naked except for black nylon stockings and a garter belt and a pair of high-heeled pumps. Patent leather pumps, as a matter of fact.
That's a vicious, damnable lie, Ullman cried.
Is it? Jack asked. He was beginning to feel better. The headache was draining away. He took the last Excedrin and chewed it up, enjoying the bitter, powdery taste as the tablet shredded in his mouth.
It was a very unfortunate occurrence, Ullman said. Now what is the point, Torrance? If you're planning to write some ugly smear article, if this is some ill-conceived, stupid blackmail idea...
Nothing of the sort, Jack said. I called because I didn't think you played square with me.
And because...
Didn't play square, Ullman cried.
My God, did you think I was going to share a large pile of dirty laundry with the hotel's caretaker? Who in heaven's name do you think you are? And how could those old stories possibly affect you anyway? Or do you think there are ghosts parading up and down the halls of the West Wing, wearing bed sheets and crying, Whoa!
No, I don't think there are any ghosts. But you raked up a lot of my personal history before you gave me the job. You had me on the carpet, quizzing me about my ability to take care of your hotel like a little boy in front of the teacher's desk for peeing in the coat room. You embarrassed me.
I just do not believe your cheek, your bloody damned impertinence, Ullman said.
He sounded as if he might be choking.
I'd like to sack you, and perhaps I will.
I think Al Shockley might object, strenuously.
And I think you may have finally overestimated Mr. Shockley's commitment to you, Mr. Torrance.
For a moment, Jack's headache came back in all its thudding glory, and he closed his eyes against the pain. As if from a distance away, he heard himself ask, Who owns the Overlook now? Is it still Derwent Enterprises? Or are you too small fry to know?
I think that will do, Mr. Torrance. You are an employee of the hotel, no different from a busboy or a kitchen pot scrubber. I have no intention of...
Okay, I'll write Al, Jack said. He'll know. After all, he's on the board of directors. And I might just add a little P.S. to the effect that
Derwent doesn't own it.
What? I couldn't quite make that out.
I said, Derwent doesn't own it. The stockholders are all Easterners.
Your friend Mr. Shockley owns the largest block of stock himself, better than 35%. You would know better than I if he has any ties to Derwent.
Who else?
I have no intention of divulging the names of the other stockholders to you, Mr. Torrance. I intend to bring this whole matter to the attention of...
One other question.
I am under no obligation to you.
Most of the Overlook's history, savory and unsavory alike, I found in a scrapbook that was in the cellar. Big thing with white leather covers, gold thread for binding. Do you have any idea whose scrapbook that might be?
None at all.
Is it possible it could have belonged to Grady, the caretaker who killed himself?
Mr. Torrance, Ullman said in tones of deepest frost, I am by no means sure that Mr. Grady could read, let alone dig out the rotten apples you have been wasting my time with.
I'm thinking of writing a book about the Overlook Hotel. I thought if I actually got through it, the owner of the scrapbook would like to have an acknowledgement at the front.
I think writing a book about the Overlook would be very unwise, Ullman said. Especially a book done from your, point of view.
Your opinion doesn't surprise me.
His headache was all gone now. There had been that one flash of pain, and that was all. His mind felt sharp and accurate, all the way down to millimeters. It was the way he usually felt only when the writing was going extremely well, or when he had a three-drink buzz on. That was another thing he had forgotten about Excedrin. He didn't know if it worked for others, but for him, crunching three tablets was like an instant high. Now he said, What you'd like is some sort of commissioned guidebook that you could hand out free to the guests when they checked in. Something with a lot of glossy photos of the mountains at sunrise and sunset and a lemon meringue text to go with it. Also a section on the colorful people who have stayed there, of course excluding the really colorful ones like Gianelli and his friends.
If I felt I could fire you and be 100% certain of my own job instead of just 95%, Ullman said in clipped, strangled tones, I would fire you right this minute, over the telephone. But since I feel that 5% of uncertainty, I intend to call Mr. Shockley the moment you're off the line, which will be soon, or so I devoutly hope.
Jack said, There isn't going to be anything in the book that isn't true, you know. There's no need to dress it up.
Why are you baiting him? Do you want to be fired?
I don't care if Chapter 5 is about the Pope of Rome screwing the shade of the Virgin Mary, Ullman said, his voice rising. I want you out of my hotel.
It's not your hotel!
Jack screamed and slammed the receiver into its cradle. He sat on the stool, breathing hard, a little scared now, a little, hell, a lot, wondering why in the name of God he had called Ullman in the first place.
You lost your temper again, Jack.
Yes. Yes, he had. No sense trying to deny it. And the hell of it was, he had no idea how much influence that cheap little prick had over Al, no more than he knew how much bullshit Al would take from him in the name of Auld Lang Syne. If Ullman was as good as he claimed to be, and if he gave Al a he-goes-or-I-go ultimatum, might not Al be forced to take it? He closed his eyes and tried to imagine telling Wendy, Guess what, babe? I lost another job. This time I had to go through 2,000 miles of Bell telephone cable to find someone to punch out, but I managed it. He opened his eyes and wiped his mouth with his handkerchief. He wanted a drink. Hell, he needed one. There was a cafe just down the street. Surely he had time for a quick beer on his way up to the park. Just one to lay the dust. He clenched his hands together helplessly. The question recurred. Why had he called Ullman in the first place? The number of the Surf Sand in Lauderdale had been written in a small notebook by the phone and the CB radio in the office. Plumbers' numbers, carpenters, glaziers, electricians, others. Jack had copied it onto the matchbook cover shortly after getting out of bed, the idea of calling Ullman full-blown and gleeful in his mind. But to what purpose? Once, during the drinking phase, Wendy had accused him of desiring his own destruction, but not possessing the necessary moral fiber to support a full-blown death wish. So he manufactured ways in which other people could do it, lopping a piece at a time off himself and their family. Could it be true? Was he afraid somewhere inside that the Overlook might be just what he needed to finish his play and generally collect up his shit and get it together? Was he blowing the whistle on himself? Please, God, no. Don't let it be that way. Please. He closed his eyes, and an image immediately arose on the darkened screen of his inner lids. Sticking his hand through that hole in the shingles to pull out the rotted flashing, the sudden needling sting, his own agonized, startled cry in the still and unheeding air. Oh, you goddamn fucking son of a bitch! Replaced with an image 2 years earlier, himself stumbling into the house at 3 in the morning, drunk, falling over a table and sprawling full length on the floor, cursing, waking Wendy up on the couch. Wendy turning on the light, seeing his clothes ripped and smeared from some cloudy parking lot scuffle that had occurred at a vaguely remembered honky-tonk just over the New Hampshire border hours before, crusted blood under his nose, now looking up at his wife, blinking stupidly in the light like a mole in the sunshine, and Wendy saying dully, "You son of a bitch, you woke Danny up. If you don't care about yourself, can't you care a little bit about us? Oh, why do I even bother talking to you?" The telephone rang, making him jump. He snatched it off the cradle, illogically sure it must be either Ullman or Al Shockley. "What?" he barked. "Your overtime, sir. $3.50. "I'll have to break some ones," he said. "Wait a minute." He put the phone on the shelf, deposited his last 6 quarters, then went out to the cashier to get more. He performed the transaction automatically, his mind running in a single closed circle like a squirrel on an exercise wheel. Why had he called Ullman? Because Ullman had embarrassed him? He had been embarrassed before, and by real masters, the Grand Master, of course, being himself. Simply to crow at the man? Expose his hypocrisy? Jack didn't think he was that petty. His mind tried to seize on the scrapbook as a valid reason, but that wouldn't hold water either. The chances of Ullman knowing who the owner was were no more than 2 in 1,000. At the interview, he had treated the seller as another country, a nasty, underdeveloped one at that. If he had really wanted to know, he would have called Watson, whose winter number was also in the office notebook. Even Watson would not have been a sure thing, but surer than Ullman. And telling him about the book idea, that had been another stupid thing, incredibly stupid. Besides jeopardizing his job, he could be closing off wide channels of information once Ullman called around and told people to beware of New Englanders bearing questions about the Overlook Hotel. He could have done his researches quietly, mailing off polite letters, perhaps even arranging some interviews in the spring, and then laughed up his sleeve at Ullman's rage when the book came out and he was safely away. The masked author strikes again. Instead, he had made that damned senseless call, lost his temper, antagonized Ullman, and brought out all the hotel manager's Little Caesar tendencies. Why? If it wasn't an effort to get himself thrown out of the good job Al had snagged for him, then what was it? He deposited the rest of the money in the slots and hung up the phone. It really was the senseless kind of thing he might have done if he had been drunk. But he had been sober. Dead cold sober. Walking out of the drugstore, he crunched another Excedrin into his mouth, grimacing yet relishing the bitter taste. On the walk outside, he met Wendy and Danny. "Hey, we were just coming after you," Wendy said. "Snowing, don't you know?" Jack blinked up. "So it is." It was snowing hard. Sidewinder's main street was already heavily powdered, the center line obscured. Danny had his head tilted up to the white sky, his mouth open and his tongue out, to catch some of the fat flakes drifting down. "Do you think this is it?" Wendy asked. Jack shrugged. "I don't know. I was hoping for another week or two of grace. We still might get it." Grace. That was it. "I'm sorry, Al. Grace. Your mercy. For your mercy. One more chance. I am heartily sorry." How many times over how many years had he, a grown man, asked for the mercy of another chance? He was suddenly so sick of himself, so revolted, that he could have groaned aloud.
How's your headache? She asked, studying him closely. He put an arm around her and hugged her tight.
Better. Come on, you two, let's go home while we still can.
They walked back to where the hotel truck was slant parked against the curb, Jack in the middle, his left arm around Wendy's shoulders, his right hand holding Danny's hand. He had called it home for the first time, for better or worse. As he got behind the truck's wheel, it occurred to him that while he was fascinated by the overlook, he didn't much like it. He wasn't sure it was good for either his wife or his son or himself. Maybe that was why he had called Ullman. To be fired while there was still time. He backed the truck out of its parking space and headed them out of town and up into the mountains. 21. Night Thoughts. It was 10 o'clock. Their quarters were filled with counterfeit sleep. Jack lay on his side facing the wall, eyes open, listening to Wendy's slow and regular breathing. The taste of dissolved aspirin was still on his tongue, making it feel rough and slightly numb. Al Shockley had called at 6:15, 7:45 back east. Wendy had been downstairs with Danny, sitting in front of the lobby fireplace and reading.
"Person to person," the operator said, "for Mr. Jack Torrance?"
"Speaking." He had switched the phone to his right hand, had dug his handkerchief out of his back pocket with his left, and had wiped his tender lips with it. Then he lit a cigarette. Al's voice then, strong in his ear.
"Jackie boy, what in the name of God are you up to?"
"Hi, Al." He snuffed the cigarette and groped for the Excedrin bottle.
"What's going on, Jack? I got this weird phone call from Stuart Ullman this afternoon. And when Stu Ullman calls long distance out of his own pocket, you know the shit has hit the fan."
"Ullman has nothing to worry about, Al. Neither do you."
"What exactly is the nothing we don't have to worry about? Stu made it sound like a cross between blackmail and a National Enquirer feature on the Overlook. Talk to me, boy."
"I wanted to poke him a little," Jack said. "When I came up here to be interviewed, he had to drag out all my dirty laundry. Drinking problem, lost your last job for racking over a student, wonder if you're the right man for this, etc. The thing that bugged me was that he was bringing all this up because he loved the goddamn hotel so much, the beautiful Overlook, the traditional Overlook, the bloody sacred Overlook. Well, I found a scrapbook in the basement. Somebody had put together all the less savory aspects of Ullman's cathedral, and it looked to me like a little black mass had been going on after hours."
"I hope that's metaphorical, Jack."
Al's voice sounded frighteningly cold.
"It is, but I did find out..." "I know the hotel's history."
Jack ran a hand through his hair. "So I called him up and poked him with it. I admit it wasn't very bright, and I sure wouldn't do it again. End of story."
"Stu says you're planning to do a little dirty laundry airing yourself."
"Stu is an asshole," he barked into the phone. "I told him I had an idea of writing about the Overlook. Yes, I do. I think this place forms an index of the whole post-World War II American character." "That sounds like an inflated claim, stated so baldly. I know it does, but it's all here, Al. My God, it could be a great book. But it's far in the future, I can promise you that. I've got more on my plate right now than I can eat. And,
Jack, that's not good enough."
He found himself gaping at the black receiver of the phone, unable to believe what he had surely heard.
"What?
Al, did you say..."
"I said what I said. How long is far in the future, Jack? For you, it may be 2 years, maybe 5. For me, it's 30 or 40, because I expect to be associated with the Overlook for a long time. The thought of you doing some sort of scum job on my hotel and passing it off as a great piece of American writing, that makes me sick."
Jack was speechless.
"I tried to help you, Jackie boy. We went through the war together, and I thought I owed you some help. You remember the war?"
"I remember it," he muttered. But the coals of resentment had begun to glow around his heart. First Ullman, then Wendy, now Al. What was this? National Let's Pick Jack Torrance Apart Week? He clamped his lips more tightly together, reached for his cigarettes, and knocked them off onto the floor. Had he ever liked this cheap prick talking to him from his mahogany-lined den in Vermont? Had he really?
"Before you hit that Hatfield, kid," Al was saying, "I had talked the board out of letting you go and even had them swung around to considering tenure. You blew that one for yourself. I got you this hotel thing, a nice quiet place for you to get yourself together, finish your play, and wait it out until Harry Effinger and I could convince the rest of those guys that they made a big mistake. Now it looks like you want to chew my arm off on your way to a bigger killing. Is that the way you say thanks to your friends, Jack?
No, he whispered. He didn't dare say more. His head was throbbing with the hot, acid-etched words that wanted to get out. He tried desperately to think of Danny and Wendy, depending on him. Danny and Wendy sitting peacefully downstairs in front of the fire and working on the first of the second-grade reading primers, thinking everything was A-okay. If he lost this job, what then? Off to California, in that tired old VW with the disintegrating fuel pump like a family of Dust Bowl Okies? He told himself he would get down on his knees and beg Al before he let that happen. But still the words struggled to pour out, and the hand holding the hot wires of his rage felt greased.
What? Al said sharply.
No, he said. That is not the way I treat my friends, and you know it.
How do I know it? At the worst, you're planning to smear my hotel by digging up bodies that were decently buried years ago. At the best, you call up my temperamental but extremely competent hotel manager and work him into a frenzy as part of some stupid kid's game.
It was more than a game, Al. It's easier for you. You don't have to take some rich friend's charity. You don't need a friend in court because you are the court. The fact that you were one step from a brown bag lush goes pretty much unmentioned, doesn't it?
I suppose it does, Al said.
His voice had dropped a notch and he sounded tired of the whole thing.
But Jack, I can't help that. I can't change that.
I know, Jack said emptily. Am I fired? I guess you better tell me if I am.
Not if you'll do two things for me.
All right.
Hadn't you better hear the conditions before you accept them?
No. Give me your deal and I'll take it. There's Wendy and Danny to think about. If you want my balls, I'll send them airmail.
Are you sure self-pity is a luxury you can afford, Jack?
He had closed his eyes and slid an Excedrin between his dry lips. At this point, I feel it's the only one I can afford.
Fire away.
No pun intended.
Al was silent for a moment. Then he said, First, no more calls to Ullman. Not even if the place burns down. If that happens, call the maintenance man, that guy who swears all the time. You know who I mean?
Watson.
Yes.
Okay, done.
Second, you promise me, Jack, word of honor, no book about a famous Colorado mountain hotel with a history.
For a moment, his rage was so great that he literally could not speak. The blood beat loudly in his ears. It was like getting a call from some 20th century Medici prince. No portraits of my family with their warts showing, please, or back to the rabble you'll go. I subsidize no pictures but pretty pictures. When you paint the daughter of my good friend and business partner, please omit birthmark or back to the rabble you'll go. Of course we're friends. We are both civilized men, aren't we? We've shared bed and board and bottle. We'll always be friends, and the dog collar I have on you will always be ignored by mutual consent, and I'll take good and benevolent care of you. All I ask in return is your soul. Small item. We can even ignore the fact that you've handed it over, the way we ignore the dog collar. Remember, my talented friend, there are Michelangelos begging everywhere in the streets of Rome.
Jack? You there?
He made a strangled noise that was intended to be the word yes. Al's voice was firm and very sure of itself.
I really don't think I'm asking so much, Jack. And there will be other books. You just can't expect me to subsidize you while you...
All right, agreed.
I don't want you to think I'm trying to control your artistic life, Jack. You know me better than that. It's just that...
Al?
What?
Is Derwent still involved with the Overlook, somehow?
I don't see how that can possibly be any concern of yours, Jack.
No, he said distantly. I suppose it isn't. Listen, Al, I think I hear Wendy calling me for something. I'll get back to you.
Sure thing, Jackie boy. We'll have a good talk. How are things? Dry?
You've got your pound of flesh, blood and all. Now can't you leave me alone?
As a bone. Here too. I'm actually beginning to enjoy sobriety. If...
I'll get back, Al. Wendy...
Sure. Okay.
And so he had hung up, and that was when the cramps had come.
hitting him like lightning bolts, making him curl up in front of the telephone like a penitent, hands over his belly, head throbbing like a monstrous bladder. The moving wasp, having stung, moves on. It had passed a little when Wendy came upstairs and asked him who had been on the phone. "Al," he said. He called to ask how things were going. I said they were fine. "Jack, you look terrible. Are you sick?"
"Headache's back. I'm going to bed early. No sense trying to write."
"Can I get you some warm milk?"
He smiled wanly. "That would be nice." And now he lay beside her, feeling her warm and sleeping thigh against his own. Thinking of the conversation with Al, how he had groveled, still made him hot and cold by turns. Someday there would be a reckoning. Someday there would be a book, not the soft and thoughtful thing he had first considered, but a gem-hard work of research, photosection and all, and he would pull apart the entire Overlook history, nasty, incestuous ownership deals and all. He would spread it all out for the reader like a dissected crayfish. And if Al Shockley had connections with the Derwent Empire, then God help him. Strung up like piano wire, he lay staring into the dark, knowing it might be hours yet before he could sleep. Wendy Torrance lay on her back, eyes closed, listening to the sound of her husband's slumber, the long inhale, the brief hold, the slightly guttural exhale. Where did he go when he slept, she wondered. To some amusement park, a great Barrington of dreams where all the rides were free, and there was no wife-mother along to tell them they'd had enough hot dogs or that they'd better be going if they wanted to get home by dark? Or was it some fathoms-deep bar where the drinking never stopped and the bat wings were always propped open and all the old companions were gathered around the electronic hockey game, glasses in hand, Al Shockley prominent among them with his tie loosened and the top button of his shirt undone? A place where both she and Danny were excluded, and the boogie went on endlessly? Wendy was worried about him, the old, helpless worry that she had hoped was behind her forever in Vermont, as if worry could somehow not cross state lines. She didn't like what the Overlook seemed to be doing to Jack and Danny. The most frightening thing, vaporous and unmentioned, perhaps unmentionable, was that all of Jack's drinking symptoms had come back, one by one, all but the drink itself. The constant wiping of the lips with hand or handkerchief as if to rid them of excess moisture. Long pauses at the typewriter, more balls of paper in the wastebasket. There had been a bottle of Excedrin on the telephone table tonight after Al had called him, but no water glass. He had been chewing them again. He got irritated over little things. He would unconsciously start snapping his fingers in a nervous rhythm when things got too quiet. Increased profanity. She had begun to worry about his temper, too. It would almost come as a relief if he would lose it, blow off steam, in much the same way that he went down to the basement first thing in the morning and last thing at night to dump the press on the boiler. It would almost be good to see him curse and kick a chair across the room or slam a door. But those things, always an integral part of his temperament, had almost wholly ceased. Yet she had the feeling that Jack was more and more often angry with her or Danny, but was refusing to let it out. The boiler had a pressure gauge, old, cracked, clotted with grease, but still workable. Jack had none. She had never been able to read him very well. Danny could, but Danny wasn't talking. And the call from Al. At about the same time it had come, Danny had lost all interest in the story they had been reading. He left her to sit by the fire, and cross to the main desk where Jack had constructed a roadway for his matchbox cars and trucks. The violent violet Volkswagen was there, and Danny had begun to push it rapidly back and forth. Pretending to read her own book, but actually looking at Danny over the top of it, she had seen an odd amalgam of the ways she and Jack expressed anxiety. The wiping of the lips, running both hands nervously through his hair, as she had done while waiting for Jack to come home from his round of the bars. She couldn't believe Al had called just to ask how things were going. If you wanted to shoot the bull, you called Al. When Al called you, that was business. Later, when she had come back downstairs, she had found Danny curled up by the fire again, reading the second-grade primer adventures of Joe and Rachel at the circus with their daddy, in complete absorbed attention. The fidgety distraction had completely disappeared. Watching him,
She had been struck again by the eerie certainty that Danny knew more and understood more than there was room for in Dr. Just Call Me Bill Edmonds' philosophy. "Hey, time for bed, Doc," she'd said. "Yeah, okay." He marked his place in the book and stood up. "Wash up and brush your teeth." "Okay." "Don't forget to use the floss." "I won't." They stood side by side for a moment, watching the wax and wane of the coals of the fire. Most of the lobby was chilly and drafty, but this circle around the fireplace was magically warm and hard to leave. "It was Uncle Al on the phone," she said casually. "Oh, yeah?" Totally unsurprised. "I wonder if Uncle Al was mad at Daddy," she said, still casually. "Yeah, he sure was," Danny said, still watching the fire. "He didn't want Daddy to write the book." "What book, Danny?" "About the hotel." The question framed on her lips was one she and Jack had asked Danny 1,000 times. "How do you know that?" She hadn't asked him. She didn't want to upset him before bed, or make him aware that they were casually discussing his knowledge of things he had no way of knowing at all. And he did know. She was convinced of that. Dr. Edmonds' patter about inductive reasoning and subconscious logic was just that, patter. Her sister. How had Danny known she was thinking about Aileen in the waiting room that day? And, "I dreamed Daddy had an accident." She shook her head as if to clear it. "Go wash up, Doc." "Okay." He ran up the stairs toward their quarters. Frowning, she had gone into the kitchen to warm Jack's milk in a saucepan. And now, lying wakeful in her bed and listening to her husband's breathing and the wind outside, miraculously they'd had only another flurry that afternoon, still no heavy snow. She let her mind turn fully to her lovely, troubling son, born with a caul over his face, a simple tissue of membrane that doctors saw perhaps once in every 700 births, a tissue that the old wives' tales said betokened the second sight. She decided that it was time to talk to Danny about the Overlook, and high time she tried to get Danny to talk to her. Tomorrow, for sure. The two of them would be going down to the Sidewinder Public Library to see if they could get him some second grade level books on an extended loan through the winter, and she would talk to him, and frankly. With that thought, she felt a little easier, and at last began to drift toward sleep. Danny lay awake in his bedroom, eyes open, left arm encircling his aged and slightly worse for wear Pooh. Pooh had lost one shoe-button eye and was oozing stuffing from 6 sprung seams, listening to his parents sleep in their bedroom. He felt as if he were standing unwilling guard over them. The nights were the worst of all. He hated the nights and the constant howl of the wind around the west side of the hotel. His glider floated overhead from a string. On his bureau, the VW model, brought up from the roadway setup downstairs, glowed a dimly fluorescent purple. His books were in the bookcase, his coloring books on the desk. "A place for everything and everything in its place," Mommy said. "Then you know where it is when you want it." But now things had been misplaced. Things were missing. Worse still, things had been added. Things you couldn't quite see, like in one of those pictures that said, "Can you see the Indians?" And if you strained and squinted, you could see some of them. The thing you had taken for a cactus at first glance was really a brave with a knife clamped in his teeth. And there were others hiding in the rocks, and you could even see one of their evil, merciless faces peering through the spokes of a covered wagon wheel. But you could never see all of them, and that was what made you uneasy. Because it was the ones you couldn't see that would sneak up behind you, a tomahawk in one hand and a scalping knife in the other. He shifted uneasily in his bed, his eyes searching out the comforting glow of the nightlight. Things were worse here. He knew that much for sure. At first they hadn't been so bad, but little by little, his daddy thought about drinking a lot more. Sometimes he was angry at Mommy and didn't know why. He went around wiping his lips with his handkerchief, and his eyes were far away and cloudy. Mommy was worried about him and Danny, too. He didn't have to shine into her to know that. It had been in the anxious way she had questioned him on the day the fire hose had seemed to turn into a snake. Mr. Halloran said he thought all mothers could shine a little bit, and she had known on that day that something had happened, but not what. He had almost told her, but a couple of things had held him back. He knew that the doctor in Sidewinder had dismissed Tony, and the things that Tony showed him as perfectly, well, almost, normal. His mother might not believe him if he told her about the hose. Worse, she might believe him in the wrong way, might think he was losing his marbles. He understood a little about losing your marbles, not as much as he did about getting a baby, which his mommy had explained to him the year before at some length, but enough. Once, at nursery school, his friend Scott had pointed out a boy named Robin Stenger, who was moping around the swings with a face almost long enough to step on. Robin's father taught arithmetic at Daddy's school, and Scott's daddy taught history there. Most of the kids at the nursery school were associated either with Stovington Prep or with the small IBM plant just outside of town. The prep kids chummed in one group, the IBM kids in another. There were cross-friendships, of course, but it was natural enough for the kids whose fathers knew each other to more or less stick together. When there was an adult scandal in one group, it almost always filtered down to the children in some wildly mutated form or other, but it rarely jumped to the other group. He and Scotty were sitting in the play rocket ship when Scotty jerked his thumb at Robin and said, "You know that kid?"
"Yeah,"
Danny said. Scott leaned forward. "His dad lost his marbles last night. They took him away."
"Yeah? Just for losing some marbles?"
Scotty looked disgusted.
"He went crazy, you know."
Scott crossed his eyes, flopped out his tongue, and twirled his index fingers in large elliptical orbits around his ears.
"They took him to the bug house."
"Wow," Danny said. "When will they let him come back?"
"Never, never, never,"
Scotty said darkly. In the course of that day and the next, Danny heard that A. Mr. Stenger had tried to kill everybody in his family, including Robin, with his World War II souvenir pistol. B. Mr. Stenger ripped the house to pieces while he was stinko. C. Mr. Stenger had been discovered eating a bowl of dead bugs and grass like they were cereal and milk, and crying while he did it. D. Mr. Stenger had tried to strangle his wife with a stocking when the Red Sox lost a big ball game. Finally, too troubled to keep it to himself, he had asked Daddy about Mr. Stenger. His daddy had taken him on his lap and had explained that Mr. Stenger had been under a great deal of strain, some of it about his family and some about his job, and some of it about things that nobody but doctors could understand. He had been having crying fits, and 3 nights ago he had gotten crying and couldn't stop it, and had broken a lot of things in the Stenger home. "It wasn't losing your marbles," Daddy said. "It was having a breakdown. And Mr. Stenger wasn't in a bug house, but in a sanitarium." But despite Daddy's careful explanations, Danny was scared. There didn't seem to be any difference at all between losing your marbles and having a breakdown, and whether you called it a bug house or a sanitarium, there were still bars on the windows, and they wouldn't let you out if you wanted to go. And his father, quite innocently, had confirmed another of Scotty's phrases unchanged, one that filled Danny with a vague and unformed dread. In the place where Mr. Stenger now lived, there were the men in the white coats. They came to get you in a truck with no windows, a truck that was gravestone gray. It rolled up to the curb in front of your house, and the men in the white coats got out and took you away from your family and made you live in a room with soft walls. And if you wanted to write home, you had to do it with Crayolas.
"When will they let him come back?"
Danny asked his father.
"Just as soon as he's better, Doc."
"But when will that be?" Danny had persisted.
"Dan," Jack said, "no one knows." And that was the worst of all. It was another way of saying, never, never, never.
A month later, Robin's mother took him out of nursery school, and they moved away from Stovington without Mr. Stenger. That had been over a year ago, after Daddy stopped taking the bad stuff, but before he had lost his job. Danny still thought about it often. Sometimes when he fell down or bumped his head or had a bellyache, he would begin to cry, and the memory would flash over him, accompanied by the fear that he would not be able to stop crying, that he would just go on and on, weeping and wailing, until his daddy went to the phone, dialed it, and said, "Hello? This is Jack Torrance at 149 Maple Line Way. My son here can't stop crying. Please send the men in the white coats to take him to the sanitarium. That's right, he's lost his marbles. Thank you." And the gray truck with no windows would come rolling up to his door. They would load him in, still weeping hysterically, and take him away. When would he see his mommy and daddy again? No one knows. It was this fear that had kept him silent. A year older, he was quite sure that his daddy and mommy wouldn't let him be taken away for thinking a fire hose was a snake. His rational mind was sure of that, but still, when he thought of telling them, that old memory rose up like a stone filling his mouth and blocking words. It wasn't like Tony. Tony had always seemed perfectly natural, until the bad dreams, of course, and his parents had also seemed to accept Tony as a more or less natural phenomenon. Things like Tony came from being bright, which they both assumed he was, the same way they assumed they were bright. But a fire hose that turned into a snake, or seeing blood and brains on the wall of the presidential suite when no one else could, those things would not be natural. They had already taken him to see a regular doctor. Was it not reasonable to assume that the men in the white coats might come next? Still, he might have told them, except he was sure, sooner or later, that they would want to take him away from the hotel, and he wanted desperately to get away from the Overlook. But he also knew that this was his daddy's last chance, that he was here at the Overlook to do more than take care of the place. He was here to work on his papers, to get over losing his job, to love Mommy, Wendy. And until very recently, it had seemed that all those things were happening. It was only lately that Daddy had begun to have trouble, since he found those papers. This inhuman place makes human monsters. What did that mean? He had prayed to God, but God hadn't told him. And what would Daddy do if he stopped working here? He had tried to find out from Daddy's mind and had become more and more convinced that Daddy didn't know. The strongest proof had come earlier this evening when Uncle Al had called his daddy up on the phone and said mean things, and Daddy didn't dare say anything back because Uncle Al could fire him from this job just the way that Mr. Cromart, the Stovington headmaster, and the board of directors had fired him from his schoolteaching job. And Daddy was scared to death of that, for him and Mommy, as well as himself. So he didn't dare say anything. He could only watch helplessly and hope that there really weren't any Indians at all. Or if there were, that they would be content to wait for bigger game and let their little three-wagon train pass unmolested. But he couldn't believe it, no matter how hard he tried. Things were worse at the Overlook now. The snow was coming, and when it did, any poor options he had would be abrogated. And after the snow, what? What then? When they were shut in and at the mercy of whatever might have only been toying with them before.
Come out here and take your medicine.
What then? Redrum. He shivered in his bed and turned over again. He could read more now. Tomorrow maybe he would try to call Tony. He would try to make Tony show him exactly what Redrum was, and if there was any way he could prevent it. He would risk the nightmares. He had to know. Danny was still awake long after his parents' false sleep had become the real thing. He rolled in his bed, twisting the sheets, grappling with a problem years too big for him, awake in the night like a single sentinel on picket. And sometime after midnight, he slept too, and then only the wind was awake, prying at the hotel and hooting in its gables under the bright, gimlet gaze of the stars. In the truck. I see a bad moon arising. I see trouble on the way. I see earthquakes and lightning. I see bad times today. Don't go round tonight. It's bound to take your life. There's a bad moon on the rise. Someone had added a very old Buick car radio under the hotel truck's dashboard, and now, tinny and choked with static, the distinctive sound of John Fogerty's Creedence Clearwater Revival Band came out of the speaker. Wendy and Danny were on their way down to Sidewinder. The day was clear and bright. Danny was turning Jack's orange library card over and over in his hands and seemed cheerful enough, but Wendy thought he looked drawn and tired, as if he hadn't been sleeping enough and was going on nervous energy alone. The song ended, and the disc jockey came on.
Yeah, that's Creedence. And speaking of bad moon, it looks like it may be rising over the KMTX listening area before long. Hard as it is to believe with the beautiful spring-like weather we've enjoyed for the last couple of 3 days, the KMTX fearless forecaster says high pressure will give way by 1 o'clock this afternoon to a widespread low-pressure area which is just going to grind to a stop in our KMTX area, up where the air is rare. Temperatures will fall rapidly, and precipitation should start around dusk,
Elevations under 7,000 feet, including the Metro Denver area, can expect a mixture of sleet and snow, perhaps freezing on some roads, and nothing but snow up here, cuz. We're looking at 1 to 3 inches below 7,000 and possible accumulations of 6 to 10 inches in central Colorado and on the slope. The Highway Advisory Board says that if you're planning to tour the mountains in your car this afternoon or tonight, you should remember that the chain law will be in effect. And don't go nowhere unless you have to. Remember, the announcer added jocularly, that's how the Donners got into trouble. They just weren't as close to the nearest 7-Eleven as they thought. A Clairol commercial came on, and Wendy reached down and snapped the radio off. You mind? That's okay. He glanced out at the sky, which was bright blue. Guess Daddy picked just the right day to trim those hedge animals, didn't he? I guess he did, Wendy said. Sure doesn't look much like snow, though, Danny added hopefully. Getting cold feet? Wendy asked. She was still thinking about that crack the disc jockey had made about the Donner Party. Nah, I guess not. Well, she thought, this is the time. If you're going to bring it up, do it now, or forever hold your peace. Danny, she said, making her voice as casual as possible, would you be happier if we went away from the Overlook, if we didn't stay the winter? Danny looked down at his hands. I guess so, he said. Yeah, but it's Daddy's job. Sometimes, she said carefully, I get the idea that Daddy might be happier away from the Overlook, too. They passed a sign which read Sidewinder 18 miles, and then she took the truck cautiously around a hairpin and shifted up into second. She took no chances on these downgrades. They scared her silly. Do you really think so? Danny asked. He looked at her with interest for a moment and then shook his head. No, I don't think so. Why not? Because he's worried about us, Danny said, choosing his words carefully. It was hard to explain. He understood so little of it himself. He found himself harking back to an incident he had told Mr. Halloran about, the big kid looking at department store radios and wanting to steal one. That had been distressing, but at least it had been clear what was going on, even to Danny, then little more than an infant. But grown-ups were always in a turmoil, every possible action muddied over by thoughts of the consequences, by self-doubt, by self-image, by feelings of love and responsibility. Every possible choice seemed to have drawbacks, and sometimes he didn't understand why the drawbacks were drawbacks. It was very hard. He thinks, Danny began again, and then looked at his mother quickly. She was watching the road, not looking at him, and he felt he could go on. He thinks maybe we'll be lonely. And then he thinks that he likes it here, and it's a good place for us. He loves us and doesn't want us to be lonely or sad. But he thinks even if we are, it might be okay in the long run. Do you know long run? She nodded. Yes, dear, I do. He's worried that if we left, he couldn't get another job, that we'd have to beg or something. Is that all? No, but the rest is all mixed up, because he's different now. Yes, she said, almost sighing. The grade eased a little, and she shifted cautiously back to third gear. I'm not making this up, Mommy, honest to God. I know that, she said, and smiled. Did Tony tell you? No, he said. I just know. That doctor didn't believe in Tony, did he? Never mind that doctor, she said. I believe in Tony. I don't know what he is or who he is, if he's a part of you that's special or if he comes from somewhere outside, but I do believe in him, Danny. And if you, he, think we should go, we will. The two of us will go and be together with Daddy again in the spring. He looked at her with sharp hope. Where? A motel? Hon, we couldn't afford a motel. It would have to be at my mother's. The hope in Danny's face died out. I know, he said, and stopped. What? Nothing, he muttered. She shifted back to second as the grade steepened again. No, Doc, please don't say that. This talk is something we should have had weeks ago, I think. So please, what is it you know? I won't be mad. I can't be mad because this is too important. Talk straight to me. I know how you feel about her, Danny said, and sighed. How do I feel? Bad, Danny said, and then rhyming, sing-song, frightening her. Bad, sad, mad. It's like she wasn't your mommy at all, like she wanted to eat you. He looked at her frightened. And I don't like it there. She's always thinking about how she would be better for me than you, and how she could get me away from you. Mommy, I don't want to go there. I'd rather be at the Overlook than there.
Wendy was shaken. Was it that bad between her and her mother? God, what hell for the boy if it was, and he could really read their thoughts for each other. She suddenly felt more naked than naked, as if she had been caught in an obscene act.
All right, she said. All right, Danny.
You're mad at me, he said in a small, near-to-tears voice.
No, I'm not. Really, I'm not. I'm just sort of shook up.
They were passing a Sidewinder 15-mile sign, and Wendy relaxed a little. From here on in, the road was better.
I want to ask you one more question, Danny. I want you to answer it as truthfully as you can. Will you do that?
Yes, Mommy, he said, almost whispering.
Has your daddy been drinking again?
No, he said, and smothered the two words that rose behind his lips after that simple negative, not yet.
Wendy relaxed a little more. She put a hand on Danny's jeans-clad leg and squeezed it.
Your daddy has tried very hard, she said softly, because he loves us. And we love him, don't we?
He nodded gravely. Speaking almost to herself, she went on.
He's not a perfect man, but he has tried. Danny, he's tried so hard. When he stopped, he went through a kind of hell. He's still going through it. I think if it hadn't been for us, he would have just let go. I want to do what's right, and I don't know. Should we go, stay? It's like a choice between the fat and the fire.
I know.
Would you do something for me, Doc?
What?
Try to make Tony come, right now. Ask him if we're safe at the Overlook.
I already tried, Danny said slowly, this morning.
What happened? Wendy asked. What did he say?
He didn't come, Danny said. Tony didn't come.
And he suddenly burst into tears.
Danny, she said, alarmed. Honey, don't do that. Please.
The truck swerved across the double yellow line, and she pulled it back, scared.
Don't take me to Grandma's, Danny said through his tears. Please, Mommy, I don't want to go there. I want to stay with Daddy.
All right, she said softly. All right, that's what we'll do.
She took a Kleenex out of the pocket of her Western-style shirt and handed it to him.
We'll stay, and everything will be fine. Just fine.
23. In the playground. Jack came out onto the porch, tugging the tab of his zipper up under his chin, blinking into the bright air. In his left hand, he was holding a battery-powered hedge clipper. He tugged a fresh handkerchief out of his back pocket with his right hand, swiped his lips with it, and tucked it away. Snow, they had said on the radio. It was hard to believe, even though he could see the clouds building up on the far horizon. He started down the path to the topiary, switching the hedge clipper over to the other hand. It wouldn't be a long job, he thought. A little touch-up would do it. The cold nights had surely stunted their growth. The rabbit's ears looked a little fuzzy, and two of the dog's legs had grown fuzzy green bone spurs, but the lion's and the buffalo looked fine. Just a little haircut would do the trick, and then let the snow come. The concrete path ended as abruptly as a diving board. He stepped off it and walked past the drained pool to the gravel path which wound through the hedge sculptures and into the playground itself. He walked over to the rabbit and pushed the button on the handle of the clippers. It hummed into quiet life.
"Hi, Br'er Rabbit," Jack said. "How are you today? Little off the top and get some of the extra off your ears? Fine. Say, did you hear the one about the traveling salesman and the old lady with a pet poodle?"
His voice sounded unnatural and stupid in his ears, and he stopped. It occurred to him that he didn't care much for these hedge animals. It had always seemed slightly perverted to him to clip and torture a plain old hedge into something that it wasn't. Along one of the highways in Vermont, there had been a hedge billboard on a high slope overlooking the road, advertising some kind of ice cream. Making nature peddle ice cream, that was just wrong. It was grotesque.
You weren't hired to philosophize, Torrance.
Ah, that was true. So true. He clipped along the rabbit's ears, brushing a small litter of sticks and twigs off onto the grass. The hedge clipper hummed in that low and rather disgustingly metallic way that all battery-powered appliances seem to have. The sun was brilliant, but it held no warmth,
and now it wasn't so hard to believe that snow was coming. Working quickly, knowing that to stop and think when you were at this kind of a task usually meant making a mistake, Jack touched up the rabbit's face. Up this close, it didn't look like a face at all, but he knew that at a distance of 20 paces or so, light and shadow would seem to suggest one, that and the viewer's imagination, and then zipped the clippers along its belly. That done, he shut the clippers off, walked down toward the playground, and then turned back abruptly to get it all at once, the entire rabbit. Yes, it looked all right. Well, he would do the dog next.
"But if it was my hotel," he said, "I'd cut the whole damn bunch of you down."
He would, too. Just cut them down and resod the lawn where they'd been and put in half a dozen small metal tables with gaily colored umbrellas. People could have cocktails on the Overlook's lawn in the summer sun. Slow gin fizzes and margaritas and pink ladies and all those sweet tourist drinks. A rum and tonic, maybe. Jack took his handkerchief out of his back pocket and slowly rubbed his lips with it. "Come on, come on," he said softly. That was nothing to be thinking about. He was going to start back, and then some impulse made him change his mind, and he went down to the playground instead. It was funny how you never knew kids, he thought. He and Wendy had expected Danny would love the playground. It had everything a kid could want. But Jack didn't think the boy had been down half a dozen times, if that. He supposed if there had been another kid to play with, it would have been different. The gate squeaked slightly as he let himself in, and then there was crushed gravel crunching under his feet. He went first to the playhouse, the perfect scale model of the Overlook itself. It came up to his lower thigh, just about Danny's height when he was standing up. Jack hunkered down and looked in the third-floor windows.
"The giant has come to eat you all up in your beds," he said hollowly. "Kiss your AAA rating goodbye."
But that wasn't funny either. You could open the house simply by pulling it apart. It opened on a hidden hinge. The inside was a disappointment. The walls were painted, but the place was mostly hollow. But of course it would have to be, he told himself, or how else could the kids get inside? What play furniture might go with the place in the summer was gone, probably packed away in the equipment shed. He closed it up and heard the small click as the latch closed. He walked over to the slide, set the hedge clipper down, and after a glance back at the driveway to make sure Wendy and Danny hadn't returned, he climbed to the top and sat down. This was the big kid's slide, but the fit was still uncomfortably tight for his grown-up ass. How long had it been since he had been on a slide? 20 years? It didn't seem possible it could be that long. It didn't feel that long, but it had to be that, or more. He could remember his old man taking him to the park in Berlin, when he had been Danny's age, and he had done the whole bit, slide, swings, teeter-totters, everything. He and the old man would have a hot dog lunch and buy peanuts from the man with the cart afterward. They would sit on a bench to eat them, and dusky clouds of pigeons would flock around their feet.
"Goddamn scavenger birds," his dad would say. "Don't you feed them, Jackie."
But they would both end up feeding them, and giggling at the way they ran after the nuts, the greedy way they ran after the nuts. Jack didn't think the old man had ever taken his brothers to the park. Jack had been his favorite, and even so, Jack had taken his lumps when the old man was drunk, which was a lot of the time. But Jack had loved him for as long as he was able, long after the rest of the family could only hate and fear him. He pushed off with his hands and went to the bottom, but the trip was unsatisfying. The slide, unused, had too much friction, and no really pleasant speed could be built up, and his ass was just too big. His adult feet thumped into the slight dip where thousands of children's feet had landed before him. He stood up, brushed at the seat of his pants, and looked at the hedge clipper. But instead of going back to it, he went to the swings, which were also a disappointment. The chains had built up rust since the close of the season, and they squealed like things in pain. Jack promised himself he would oil them in the spring. "You better stop it," he advised himself. "You're not a kid anymore. You don't need this place to prove it." But he went on to the cement rings. They were too small for him, and he passed them up, and then to the security fence which marked the edge of the grounds. He curled his fingers through the links and looked through, the sun cross-hatching shadow lines on his face like a man behind bars. He recognized the similarity himself, and he shook the chain link, put a harried expression on his face, and whispered,
"Let me out of here." Let me out of here.
But for the third time, not funny. It was time to get back to work. That was when he heard the sound behind him. He turned around quickly, frowning, embarrassed, wondering if someone had seen him fooling around down here in Kitty Country. His eyes ticked off the slides, the opposing angles of the seesaws, the swings in which only the wind sat. Beyond all that, to the gate and the low fence that divided the playground from the lawn and the topiary, the lions gathered protectively around the path, the rabbit bent over as if to crop grass, the buffalo ready to charge, the crouching dog. Beyond them, the putting green and the hotel itself. From here, he could even see the raised lip of the roque court on the overlook's western side. Everything was just as it had been. So why had the flesh of his face and hands begun to creep? And why had the hair along the back of his neck begun to stand up, as if the flesh back there had suddenly tightened? He squinted up at the hotel again, but that was no answer. It simply stood there, its windows dark, a tiny thread of smoke curling from the chimney, coming from the banked fire in the lobby. Buster, you better get going, or they're going to come back and wonder if you were doing anything all the while. Sure, get going, because the snow was coming and he had to get the damn hedges trimmed. It was part of the agreement. Besides, they wouldn't dare. Who wouldn't? What wouldn't? Dare do what? He began to walk back toward the hedge clipper at the foot of the big kid's slide, and the sound of his feet crunching on the crushed stone seemed abnormally loud. Now the flesh on his testicles had begun to creep too, and his buttocks felt hard and heavy, like stone. Jesus, what is this? He stopped by the hedge clipper, but made no move to pick it up. Yes, there was something different. In the topiary. And it was so simple, so easy to see, that he just wasn't picking it up. Come on, he scolded himself. You just trim the fucking rabbit, so what's the... That's it. His breath stopped in his throat. The rabbit was down on all fours, cropping grass. Its belly was against the ground. But not 10 minutes ago, it had been up on its hind legs. Of course it had been. He had trimmed its ears and its belly. His eyes darted to the dog. When he had come down the path, it had been sitting up as if begging for a sweet. Now it was crouched, head tilted, the clipped wedge of mouth seeming to snarl silently. And the lions, oh no, baby, oh no, no way. The lions were closer to the path. The two on his right had subtly changed positions, had drawn closer together. The tail of the one on the left now almost jutted out over the path. When he had come past them and through the gate, that lion had been on the right, and he was quite sure its tail had been curled around it. They were no longer protecting the path. They were blocking it. Jack put his hand suddenly over his eyes and then took it away. The picture didn't change. A soft sigh, too quiet to be a groan, escaped him. In his drinking days, he had always been afraid of something like this happening. But when you were a heavy drinker, you called it the DTs. Good old Ray Milland in Lost Weekend, seeing the bugs coming out of the walls. What did you call it when you were cold sober? The question was meant to be rhetorical, but his mind answered it. You call it insanity. Nevertheless. Staring at the hedge animals, he realized something had changed while he had his hand over his eyes. The dog had moved closer. No longer crouching, it seemed to be in a running posture, haunches flexed, one front leg forward, the other back. The hedge mouth yawned wider. The pruned sticks looked sharp and vicious. And now he fancied he could see faint eye indentations in the greenery as well. Looking at him. Why do they have to be trimmed? He thought hysterically. They're perfect. Another soft sound. He involuntarily backed up a step when he looked at the lions. One of the two on the right seemed to have drawn slightly ahead of the other. Its head was lowered. One paw had stolen almost all the way to the low fence. Dear God, what next? Next it leaps over and gobbles you up like something in an evil nursery fable. It was like that game they had played when they were kids, Red Light. One person was it, and while he turned his back and counted to 10, the other players crept forward. When it got to 10, he whirled around, and if he caught anyone moving, they were out of the game. The others remained frozen in statue postures until it turned his back and counted again. They got closer and closer, and at last, somewhere between 5 and 10, you would feel a hand on your back. Gravel rattled on the path. He jerked his head around to look at the dog, and it was halfway down the pathway, just behind the lions now, its mouth wide and yawning. Before, it had only been a hedge clipped in the general shape of a dog, something that lost all definition when you got up close to it. But now Jack could see that it had been clipped to look like a German shepherd, and shepherds could be mean. You could train shepherds to kill. A low, rustling sound. The lion on the left had advanced all the way to the fence now. Its muzzle was touching the boards. It seemed to be grinning at him. Jack backed up another 2 steps. His head was thudding crazily, and he could feel the dry rasp of his breath in his throat. Now the buffalo had moved, circling to the right, behind and around the rabbit. The head was lowered, the green hedge horns pointing at him. The thing was, you couldn't watch all of them, not all at once. He began to make a whining sound, unaware in his locked concentration that he was making any sound at all. His eyes darted from one hedge creature to the next, trying to see them move. The wind gusted, making a hungry, rattling sound in the close matted branches. What kind of sound would there be if they got him? But of course he knew. A snapping, rending, breaking sound. It would be, no, I will not believe this, not at all. He clapped his hands over his eyes, clutching at his hair, his forehead, his throbbing temples. And he stood like that for a long time, dread building until he could stand it no longer, and he pulled his hands away with a cry. By the putting green, the dog was sitting up, as if begging for a scrap. The buffalo was gazing with disinterest back toward the rope court, as it had been when Jack had come down with the clippers. The rabbit stood on its hind legs, ears up to catch the faintest sound, freshly clipped belly exposed. The lions, rooted into place, stood beside the path. He stood frozen for a long time, the harsh breath in his throat finally slowing. He reached for his cigarettes and shook 4 of them out onto the gravel. He stooped down and picked them up, groped for them, never taking his eyes from the topiary for fear the animals would begin to move again. He picked them up, stuffed 3 carelessly back into the pack, and lit the 4th. After 2 deep drags, he dropped it and crushed it out. He went to the hedge clipper and picked it up. "I'm very tired," he said. And now it seemed okay to talk out loud. It didn't seem crazy at all. "I've been under strain. The wasps, the play, Al calling me like that. But it's all right." He began to trudge back up to the hotel. Part of his mind tugged fretfully at him, tried to make him detour around the hedge animals, but he went directly up the gravel path, through them. A faint breeze rattled through them, that was all. He had imagined the whole thing. He had had a bad scare, but it was over now. In the Overlook's kitchen, he paused to take 2 Excedrin, and then went downstairs and looked at papers until he heard the dim sound of the hotel truck rattling into the driveway. He went up to meet them. He felt all right. He saw no need to mention his hallucination. He'd had a bad scare, but it was over now. 24. Snow. It was dusk. They stood on the porch in the fading light, Jack in the middle, his left arm around Danny's shoulders, and his right arm around Wendy's waist. Together, they watched as the decision was taken out of their hands. The sky had been completely clouded over by 2:30, and it had begun to snow an hour later, and this time you didn't need a weatherman to tell you it was serious snow, no flurry that was going to melt or blow away when the evening wind started to whoop. At first, it had fallen in perfectly straight lines, building up a snow cover that coated everything evenly. But now, an hour after it had started, the wind had begun to blow from the northwest, and the snow had begun to drift against the porch and the sides of the Overlook's driveway. Beyond the grounds, the highway had disappeared under an even blanket of white. The hedge animals were also gone. But when Wendy and Danny had gotten home, she had commended him on the good job he had done. "Do you think so?" he had asked, and said no more. Now the hedges were buried under amorphous white cloaks. Curiously, all of them were thinking different thoughts, but feeling the same emotion. Relief. The bridge had been crossed.
Will it ever be spring?
Wendy murmured.
Jack squeezed her tighter.
Before you know it. What do you say we go in and have some supper? It's cold out here.
She smiled.
All afternoon Jack had seemed distant and, well, odd. Now he sounded more like his normal self.
Fine by me. How about you, Danny?
Sure.
So they went in together, leaving the wind to build to the low-pitched scream that would go on all night, a sound they would get to know well. Flakes of snow swirled and danced across the porch. The overlook faced it, as it had for nearly three-quarters of a century, its darkened windows now bearded with snow, indifferent to the fact that it was now cut off from the world. Or possibly it was pleased with the prospect. Inside its shell, the three of them went about their early evening routine, like microbes trapped in the intestine of a monster.
25. Inside 217. A week and a half later, 2 feet of snow lay white and crisp and even on the grounds of the Overlook Hotel. The hedge menagerie was buried up to its haunches. The rabbit, frozen on its hind legs, seemed to be rising from a white pool. Some of the drifts were over 5 feet deep. The wind was constantly changing them, sculpting them into sinuous, dune-like shapes. Twice Jack had snowshoed clumsily around to the equipment shed for his shovel to clear the porch. The third time he shrugged, simply cleared a path through the towering drift lying against the door, and let Danny amuse himself by sledding to the right and left of the path. The truly heroic drifts lay against the overlook's west side. Some of them towered to a height of 20 feet, and beyond them the ground was scoured bare to the grass by the constant wind flow. The first floor windows were covered, and the view from the dining room which Jack had so admired on closing day was now no more exciting than a view of a blank movie screen. Their phone had been out for the last 8 days, and the CB radio in Ullman's office was now their only communications link with the outside world. It snowed every day now, sometimes only brief flurries that powdered the glittering snow crust, sometimes for real, the low whistle of the wind cranking up to a womanish shriek that made the old hotel rock and groan alarmingly, even in its deep cradle of snow. Night temperatures had not gotten above 10 degrees, and although the thermometer by the kitchen service entrance sometimes got as high as 25 degrees in the early afternoons, the steady knife edge of the wind made it uncomfortable to go out without a ski mask. But they all did go out on the days when the sun shone, usually wearing 2 sets of clothing and mittens on over their gloves. Getting out was almost a compulsive thing. The hotel was circled with the double track of Danny's flexible flyer. The permutations were nearly endless. Danny riding while his parents pulled. Daddy riding and laughing while Wendy and Danny tried to pull. It was just possible for them to pull him on the icy crust, and flatly impossible when powder covered it. Danny and Mommy riding. Wendy riding by herself while her menfolk pulled and puffed white vapor like dray horses, pretending she was heavier than she was. They laughed a great deal on these sled excursions around the house, but the whooping and impersonal voice of the wind, so huge and hollowly sincere, made their laughter seem tinny and forced. They had seen caribou tracks in the snow, and once the caribou themselves, a group of 5 standing motionlessly below the security fence. They had all taken turns with Jack's Zeiss Icon binoculars to see them better, and looking at them had given Wendy a weird, unreal feeling. They were standing leg-deep in the snow that covered the highway, and it came to her that between now and the spring thaw, the road belonged more to the caribou than it did to them. Now the things that men had made up here were neutralized. The caribou understood that, she believed. She had put the binoculars down and had said something about starting lunch, and in the kitchen she had cried a little, trying to rid herself of the awful pent-up feeling that sometimes fell on her like a large pressing hand over her heart. She thought of the caribou. She thought of the wasps Jack had put out on the service entrance platform under the Pyrex bowl to freeze. There were plenty of snowshoes hung from nails in the equipment shed, and Jack found a pair to fit each of them, although Danny's pair was quite a bit outsized. Jack did well with them. Although he had not snowshoed since his boyhood in Berlin, New Hampshire, He retaught himself quickly. Wendy didn't care much for it. Even 15 minutes of tramping around on the outsized laced paddles made her legs and ankles ache outrageously. But Danny was intrigued and working hard to pick up the knack. He still fell often, but Jack was pleased with his progress. He said that by February Danny would be skipping circles around both of them. This day was overcast, and by noon the sky had already begun to spit snow. The radio was promising another 8 to 12 inches, and chanting hosannas to precipitation, that great god of Colorado skiers. Wendy, sitting in the bedroom and knitting a scarf, thought to herself that she knew exactly what the skiers could do with all that snow. She knew exactly where they could put it. Jack was in the cellar. He had gone down to check the furnace and boiler. Such checks had become a ritual with him since the snow had closed them in, and after satisfying himself that everything was going well, he had wandered through the arch, screwed the light bulb on, and had seated himself in an old and cobwebby camp chair he had found. He was leafing through the old records and papers, constantly wiping his mouth with his handkerchief as he did so. Confinement had leached his skin of its autumn tan, and as he sat hunched over the yellowed, crackling sheets, his reddish-blonde hair tumbling untidily over his forehead, he looked slightly lunatic. He had found some odd things tucked in among the invoices, bills of lading, receipts. Disquieting things. A bloody strip of sheeting. A dismembered teddy bear that seemed to have been slashed to pieces. A crumpled sheet of violet ladies' stationery. A ghost of perfume still clinging to it beneath the musk of age. A note begun and left unfinished in faded blue ink. Dearest Tommy, I can't think so well up here as I'd hoped. About us, I mean, of course. Who else? Ha ha. Things keep getting in the way. I've had strange dreams about things going bump in the night. Can you believe that? And... that was all. The note was dated June 27th, 1934. He found a hand puppet that seemed to be either a witch or a warlock, something with long teeth and a pointy hat at any rate. It had been improbably tucked between a bundle of natural gas receipts and a bundle of receipts for Vichy water. And something that seemed to be a poem, scribbled on the back of a menu in dark pencil. Medoc, are you here? I've been sleepwalking again, my dear. The plants are moving under the rug. No date on the menu, and no name on the poem, if it was a poem. Elusive, but fascinating. It seemed to him that these things were like pieces in a jigsaw, things that would eventually fit together if he could find the right linking pieces. And so he kept looking, jumping and wiping his lips every time the furnace roared into life behind him. Danny was standing outside room 217 again. The passkey was in his pocket. He was staring at the door with a kind of drugged avidity, and his upper body seemed to twitch and jiggle beneath his flannel shirt. He was humming softly and tunelessly. He hadn't wanted to come here, not after the fire hose. He was scared to come here. He was scared that he had taken the passkey again, disobeying his father. He had wanted to come here. Curiosity killed the cat, satisfaction brought him back. Was like a constant fishhook in his brain, a kind of nagging siren song that would not be appeased. And hadn't Mr. Halloran said, I don't think there's anything here that can hurt you. You promised. Promises were made to be broken. He jumped at that. It was as if that thought had come from outside, insectile, buzzing, softly cajoling. Promises were made to be broken, my dear Redrum, to be broken, splintered, shattered. Hammered apart. Four. His nervous humming broke into low, atonal song. Lulu, skip to my loo, skip to my loo, my darling. Hadn't Mr. Halloran been right? Hadn't that been, in the end, the reason why he had kept silent and allowed the snow to close them in? Just close your eyes and it will be gone. What he had seen in the presidential suite had gone away. And the snake had only been a fire hose that had fallen onto the rug. Yes, even the blood in the presidential suite had been harmless, something old, something that had happened long before he was born or even thought of, something that was done with, like a movie that only he could see. There was nothing, really nothing, in this hotel that could hurt him, and if he had to prove that to himself by going into this room, shouldn't he do so?
Lulu, skip to my loo.
Curiosity killed the cat, my dear Redrum, Redrum, my dear. Satisfaction brought him back, safe and sound, from toes to crown, from head to ground, he was safe and sound. He knew that those things are like scary pictures. They can't hurt you, but oh my God, what big teeth you have, Grandma, and is that a wolf in a bluebeard suit, or a bluebeard in a wolf suit? And I'm so glad you asked, because curiosity killed that cat, and it was the hope of satisfaction that brought him up the hall, treading softly over the blue and twisting jungle carpet. He had stopped by the fire extinguisher, had put the brass nozzle back in the frame, and then had poked it repeatedly with his finger, heart thumping, whispering, "Come on and hurt me. Come on and hurt me, you cheap prick. Can't do it, can you, huh? You're nothing but a cheap fire hose. Can't do nothing but lie there. Come on. Come on." He had felt insane with bravado, and nothing had happened. It was only a hose, after all. Only canvas and brass. You could hack it to pieces, and it would never complain, never twist and jerk and bleed green slime all over the blue carpet, because it was only a hose, not a nose and not a rose, not glass buttons or satin bows, not a snake and a sleepy doze. And he had hurried on because he was late. "I'm late," said the white rabbit. The white rabbit. Yes. Now there was a white rabbit out by the playground. Once it had been green, but now it was white, as if something had shocked it repeatedly on the snowy, windy nights and turned it old. Danny took the pass key from his pocket and slid it into the lock.
Lulu.
The white rabbit had been on its way to a croquet party, to the Red Queen's croquet party. Storks for mallets, hedgehogs for balls. He touched the key, let his fingers wander over it. His head felt dry and sick. He turned the key, and the tumblers thumped back smoothly.
"Off with his head! Off with his head! Off with his head!"
This game isn't croquet, though the mallets are too short. This game is
whack! Boom! Straight through the wicket! Off with his head!
Danny pushed the door open. It swung smoothly, without a creak. He was standing just outside a large combination bed sitting room, and although the snow had not reached up this far, the highest drifts were still a foot below the second-floor windows. The room was dark because Daddy had closed all the shutters on the western exposure 2 weeks ago. He stood in the doorway, fumbled to his right, and found the switchplate. Two bulbs in an overhead cut-glass fixture came on. Danny stepped further in and looked around. The rug was deep and soft, a quiet rose color, soothing. A double bed with a white coverlet. A writing desk, pray tell me, why is a raven like a writing desk? By the large, shuttered window. During the season, the constant writer, having a wonderful time, wish you were fear, would have a pretty view of the mountains to describe to the folks back home. He stepped further in. Nothing here. Nothing at all. Only an empty room, cold because Daddy was heating the east wing today. A bureau, a closet, its door open to reveal a clutch of hotel hangers, the kind you can't steal. A Gideon Bible on an end table. To his left was the bathroom door, a full-length mirror on it reflecting his own white-faced image. That door was ajar and... He watched his double nod slowly. Yes, that's where it was, whatever it was. In there, in the bathroom. His double walked forward, as if to escape the glass. It put its hand out, pressed it against his own. Then it fell away at an angle, as the bathroom door swung open. He looked in. A long room, old-fashioned, like a Pullman car. Tiny white hexagonal tiles on the floor. At the far end, a toilet with the lid up. At the right, a wash basin and another mirror above it, the kind that hides a medicine cabinet. To the left, a huge white tub on claw feet, the shower curtain pulled closed. Danny stepped into the bathroom and walked toward the tub dreamily, as if propelled from outside himself, as if this whole thing were one of the dreams Tony had brought him, that he would perhaps see something nice when he pulled the shower curtain back, something Daddy had forgotten or Mommy had lost, something that would make them both happy. So he pulled the shower curtain back. The woman in the tub had been dead for a long time. She was bloated and purple, her gas-filled belly rising out of the cold, ice-rimmed water like some fleshy island. Her eyes were fixed on Danny's, glassy and huge, like marbles. She was grinning, her purple lips pulled back in a grimace. Her breasts lolled. Her pubic hair floated. Her hands were frozen on the knurled porcelain sides of the tub, like crab claws. Danny shrieked, but the sound never escaped his lips. Turning inward and inward, it fell down in his darkness like a stone in a well. He took a single blundering step backward, hearing his heels clack on the white hexagonal tiles, and at the same moment his urine broke, spilling effortlessly out of him. The woman was sitting up. Still grinning, her huge marble eyes fixed on him, she was sitting up. Her dead palms made squittering noises on the porcelain. Her breasts swayed like ancient, cracked punching bags. There was the minute sound of breaking ice shards. She was not breathing. She was a corpse, and dead long years. Danny turned and ran, bolting through the bathroom door, his eyes starting from their sockets, his hair on end like the hair of a hedgehog about to be turned into a sacrificial croquet or roque ball, his mouth open and soundless. He ran full tilt into the outside door of 217, which was now closed. He began hammering on it, far beyond realizing that it was unlocked, and he had only to turn the knob to let himself out. His mouth pealed forth deafening screams that were beyond human auditory range. He could only hammer on the door and hear the dead woman coming for him, bloated belly, dry hair, outstretched hands, something that had lain slain in that tub for perhaps years, embalmed there in magic. The door would not open, would not, would not, would not. And then the voice of Dick Halloran came to him, so sudden and unexpected, so calm, that his locked vocal cords opened, and he began to cry weakly, not with fear, but with blessed relief. I don't think they can hurt you. They're like pictures in a book. Close your eyes, and they'll be gone. His eyelids snapped down, his hands curled into balls, his shoulders hunched with the effort of his concentration. Nothing there, nothing there, not there at all, nothing there, there is nothing. Time passed, and he was just beginning to relax, just beginning to realize that the door must be unlocked and he could go, when the year's damp, bloated, fish-smelling hands closed softly around his throat, and he was turned implacably around to stare into that dead and purple face.